Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London. This is a podcast that tries to tell the amazing history of the City of London as a narrative tale. Because of the sheer amount of information I've been throwing at people, and in my desire to make every episode stand alone, I'm just going to start with the story so far. London is engaged in a battle between two political giants. On the one hand is a man called John de Northampton. He is a radical firebrand with his finger on the pulse of the city. But beneath the brilliant demagogue lies the heart of an excellent political operator. Some years before, he managed to utterly reorganise the way the City of London was run. A series of reforms and constitutional changes, all wrapped up in a book which is known as the Jubilee. This created a second body to help run the City of London. Previous to it, the Court of the Aldermen ran the city, as they had for the last few centuries. To this was now added the Common Council. The council was a more democratic body, even if no one would call it democratic today. You see, back then, no one had an automatic right to vote, not even in small local elections. How mayors were chosen was relatively simple. The aldermanic court members would vote for one of their own to become the mayor. And how did the aldermen of London get chosen? Well, they represented the wards of London. These were their constituencies. And the free men of the city who lived in the ward, and to become a free man you had to be a taxpayer and a richer citizen, would pick one of their community and one of their own to be their alderman. Once upon a time, the aldermen of London basically held the post for life, but John de Northampton's reforms had seen to it that aldermen had to be recertified yearly, and then he added a rule which said no alderman could hold the post for more than 2 years. The big reform was the Common Council, because this was made up of men chosen by the craft guilds of London, the livery companies. Each profession elected between 4 and 6 members of their guild to sit upon the council, and the Court of Aldermen was obligated to meet with them and listen to them every 8 weeks or so. Despite membership of the Common Council being restricted to men in certain professions, this nominally made it much more democratic, because it had meant that men who did not qualify to become freemen of the city could now have a voice. It allowed the working classes of London to have a say. This is where John de Northampton had radically changed the city. But for all his success, he had fallen victim to the conservative elements of London, who had conspired to betray him, remove him and his followers from holding positions in the Common Council, and left him isolated and lost. But then, because of his affiliation to the King's uncle John of Gaunt, who was dominating politics in Britain, the conservative factions of London had been forced to kind of make John de Northampton the mayor. And this time, rather than awaiting the conservatives backstabbing him, he decided to strike first. For 2 years, he had gained political dominance over London. He restored the ancient rights of the city. He had obliterated the fishmongers, his most stalwart rivals, from political power. He had reduced and scattered his opponents, and he was seemingly on a roll. But he had just faced his greatest enemy, Nicholas Brembe, in the election for mayor. Brembe is the other political giant of this time, and he was a man who started life as a wool merchant and had now become the political operator in the city. He was brilliant, he was driven, and he was utterly untrustworthy. He had left in his wake a series of betrayals and duplicitous manoeuvres that seen him twice rise to become the power in the city. While his fellow grocers had cowered from John de Northampton, while his allies the fishmongers had been destroyed, Nicholas Brembe had defied John de Northampton and his bloody book of rules. A very tough campaign to elect the new mayor followed, and Nicholas Brembe had won. He was now the mayor of London for a second time. But with the stakes this high, this battle was far from over. Got that? Okay, let's get into it. Welcome to the next part of the Saga of the Jubilee and chapter 136 of The Story of London. a very London civil war. So Nicholas Brembe was now the Mayor of London. John de Northampton was not going to take this lying down. The very first thing he did was try to get the Duke of Lancaster, John of Gaunt, to issue a writ declaring Brembe's election invalid. But he was refused in this, almost certainly because the Duke of Lancaster knew he no longer had the power to influence his nephew, the King, to nullify the mayoral election. Grimly, John de Northampton carried on his struggle to oust Nicholas Brembe. In defeat, he saw that not only was he out of office, but under Brembe, the reforms he had helped bring about, however small, would be lost. John de Northampton was no Democrat. He just was considerably more democratically minded than Brembe ever could be. In the election of that man, what was at stake for John de Northampton was more than just his political career. It was the future direction of the city. As such, de Northampton, rather hypocritically, refused to accept the election result. He refused to go with the alderman in the customary fashion to Nicholas Brembe's house to announce the result of the election. The following day, he assaulted the city's chamberlain, Richard Odiham, who was a grocer, to the extent that people thought that Odiham's life was in danger. The reason for the attack? Odiham had accepted the fact that Brembe had won. Tensions were clearly high. Northampton was persuaded to agree to a public reconciliation with Nicholas Brembe in St. Anthony's Church, in which the two men embraced. But despite this, neither man trusted the other. Both immediately began conspiring with their fellows in secret meetings and conventicles. Throughout the weeks following the election, John de Northampton's followers met in St. Paul's Churchyard, in the Taylor's Hall, in the Goldsmith Hall, in the parish of St. Mary Le Bow and elsewhere, so that the city was kept in a ferment of unrest. It is important to point out, however, that Northampton at this point made no open move against the city's government. Now, some will say this is because he had judged the dissident forces in London were too weak to engineer a coup d'etat. It could also have been that he was not doing this to take over, but rather to create an atmosphere which would prevent Brembe from doing what he did last time he had power and systematically attacking Northampton and all of his followers. That this was him simply learning from what happened last time. This was Northampton moving to prevent Brembe's natural autocratic and vicious temperament from being allowed to be itself. For his part, Brembe was acting exactly like he had in 1376. He was moving against his enemies. He persuaded the king, by the judicious offering of some timely loans, to grant an additional new charter for London, the Inspeximus, which was decreed on the 26th of November 1383. This charter offered something to every citizen and was basically an attempt to nullify the grievances that John de Northampton had been exploiting recently. It reiterated the old cherished protections against foreigners. Merchants, not freemen of the city, could now only sell their goods wholesale to the citizens, and they had to sell their imports within 40 days of arriving. They could lodge only with the citizens of London, and all brokers had to be elected by the professions they served. And the weights and scales used for weighing goods between the merchants were now to be in the keeping of, well, those people elected by the commonalty. At the same time he did this, Nicholas Brembe also tried to allay the fears of the merchanting crafts which John de Northampton had exploited. The charter had in it provisions against merchants hoarding merchandise or food coming into London. All victuallers, not only the fishmongers, but the other dealers in food and wine, had to be under the rule and governance of the mayor and the aldermen. The fears and resentments which had been aroused by the Duke of Lancaster's attack on the city in 1377, and by the behaviour of the Marshal and the Constable of the Tower and all the royal purveyors, which had been one of the reasons why the Londoners had joined in the Peasants' Revolt, were also dealt with by provisions which limited their power to intervene in the city's life. Brembe also added the provision which said no mayor in future would be made to take a novel oath, such as that which John de Northampton had introduced as part of his campaign against the fishmongers. There was also an article criticising the factional politics of Northampton. It advised any freeman with a grievance to present it before the mayor and aldermen, instead of resorting to other means to enforce their rights. Looking at you, Common Council. The charter was accompanied by a royal writ proclaiming the repeal of the statutes against the fishmongers by Parliament. They were permitted to continue their business, provided they acknowledged the authority of the mayor and the aldermen over them. Nicholas Brembe, however, with his new allies in the Mercers, saw no reason to show any loyalty to his former partners, the fishmongers. He did throw them under the bus. He issued a clarification stating that the reinstatement of the fishmongers did not prohibit the importation of fish into the city and its sale to non-citizens. Brembe had no intention of allowing the fishmongers' claim to their former monopoly jeopardize his new fragile political alliance. Although this new royal charter satisfied almost every conceivable grievance which John de Northampton had been able to exploit against him, Brembe wasn't able to use this as a killing blow. His problem was he was a known quantity in London. His problem was simple. A leopard not only cannot change its spots, everyone knows eventually it's going to try and eat your face. Nicholas Brembe had shown his ruthlessness last time he gained political power. Everybody knew his promises were self-serving, and the way he had allowed the fishmongers wither and die to suit his new political agenda reminded everyone he had loyalty to none. Despite all he had done, John de Northampton, armed as he was by a strong force of personality and natural political skills, remained a real danger that could unseat Brembe. Brembe knew that Northampton could ultimately stir up a series of popular disturbances, a major riot. And if the Duke of Lancaster regained his influence over the court, he could curtail the new mayor. Northampton's secret meetings and conspiracies then continued. One cannot tell if they were being held to plan how to defend themselves against Brembe's worst successes, or if they were planning to go on the offensive. Certainly, Nicholas Brembe was acting like he always did. He launched a series of prosecutions and the binding over of the lesser men who were allied to Northampton to keep the peace. And he also proclaimed a full curfew to be inflicted on London after 9 o'clock. Northampton, for his part, rejected an attempt by the aldermen Woolworth, Philpot and a couple of grocers to conciliate him to the mayor. Depending on the historian you read, this was either because he was an arrogant smeghead, or it was because he knew Brembe would not keep any promises he made in this respect. The crisis appeared to be about to erupt. Brembe decided he had to strike fast. The leopard only knows one tactic. It must attack. This attack was possible with the help of the young king, who, now the City of London was supporting him financially, was determined to break free from the Duke of Lancaster and his protege, who had just been Mayor of London. On the 22nd of January 1384, both Nicholas Brembe and John de Northampton were suddenly summoned to appear before the King's Council. When they arrived, Northampton was ordered to behave peaceably and to hold no more meetings in the city and its suburbs without the consent of the mayor. John de Northampton had no choice but to obey. But on the same day, on his way back, Brembe struck. Northampton was ambushed and was frog-marched to appear at the mayor's own house, Le Rieur. There he was mansplained by two sheriffs and by five drapers of London to obey the city officers, to preserve the peace, quote, and to not make or cause to be made any coven, conventicle, league, or congregation openly or secretly by himself, by means of others, or by any other thing by his means or speech, whereby rumour, disturbance, commotion and affray might in any way arise within the liberty of the city to the disturbance of the peace, unquote. Who? The penalty for breaking these orders was to be a fine of £5,000. John de Northampton was bound over. John de Northampton knew he could not defy this order so soon after the order from the king. Hence he agreed to the terms placed before him, and then left, still retaining his liberty. Nicholas Brembe knew that what he was doing would be unpopular, which is why he decided to do it in his home rather than at Guildhall, just to avoid any public confrontation. But realistically, both of these two men knew this was all folly and pantomime. Neither of these men are saints. Both today would be treated with contempt, so blinkered are they in their politics. But there was an honest brutality to them both. Brembe knew, with Northampton still at liberty, he would have to take his rival down. Only one could be active in the city, and for his part, John de Northampton knew that unless he toppled Brembe, it was inevitable the grocer was going to come for him again. 4 days after the ambush at Brembe's house, on January 26, John de Northampton defied the injunctions laid upon him and held a big meeting of his supporters. He afterwards told former Mayor Woolworth, possibly inspired by arrogant bravado, but he could have been accurate, that he could have summoned 8,000 more men to that meeting if he had wished to. Prominent amongst those who did answer this call were his old allies amongst the goldsmiths and the tailors. There are hints of increased Taylor's involvement with Northampton's movement that suggests he'd broaden his appeal beyond the narrow interests of the drapers to attract all those London cloth workers who saw in the booming exports in the 1380s the opportunity to rise in the world and become exporters themselves on a par with the established merchants of the drapers, the mercers and the grocers' companies. The formation of a new draper's fraternity in Northampton's parish and stronghold of St. Mary Le Bow implies that Northampton may have founded his own breakaway fraternity, which he directly controlled. Northampton still had his finger on the pulse of the residents of the city, far more than Brembe could ever hope to reach. But he understood how to play the oligarchs of London better, and with them, well, they'd bring the men who depended upon the oligarchs for a living, creating his own legion of London. Brembe's response to Northampton's open defiance was to summon a special meeting of the Common Council, composed of, quote, an immense commonality of honest and discreet men of the city, unquote. This description implies that it included far more than the usual representatives of the guilds, and its composition was deliberately intended to give a powerful public backing for the destruction of the political system John de Northampton had built up. There was clearly a plan going on. They provided ordinances for the Common Council to vote upon, which had, surprise, surprise, been drawn up beforehand by a committee. A committee which had been appointed, quote, to consider how matters in the Common Council have been carried by clamour rather than by reason, and sometimes by members who were not qualified to sit, whereby tumults had arisen, unquote. The fix was in. The new measures took away from the guilds the elections for the Common Council and gave the elections back to the wards, with the proviso that no more than 8 persons of the same guild were to be elected. This condition reassured the crafts that the Common Council would not be swamped by the larger livery companies. And it also decreed that the number of common councillors elected should be proportionate to the population of the wards. Some historians maintain that these measures by Brembe were only to prevent abuse by Northampton's followers. And according to the letter of the changes, there's nothing in these measures that could be interpreted as him trying to impose a new oligarchy upon London. The problem with this argument is this is Nicholas Brembe we're talking about. Of course, it was nothing but a stepping stone. These measures replaced the rules set down in the Jubilee Book. The intention was to recreate the old London oligarchy. End of story. But before that, before he could properly do that, he had to destroy John de Northampton. on the 4th of February, Nicholas Brembe instructed the aldermen to summon all the inhabitants of their wards to take an oath to keep the peace. And they were to elect new aldermen, but this time sitting aldermen could be re-elected in contravention of the ordinances of 1377, but that had insisted on the 1 year's gap. Brembe was committed. The new oligarchy needed to hold power and to hell with the bloody rules. Not content with filling the court of aldermen with his people, the new common councillors were also to be elected from the wards, as we said. These instructions were accompanied by an order to the aldermen to organise all the armed men in their wards, to clothe them in red gowns and employ them as watchmen and keepers of the peace. Brembe was deliberately picking a fight. He knew that an armed conflict with Northampton's followers was due, and he knew that by ignoring the Jubilee, there could be no other way. He was laying out the bait, and Northampton took it. On February the 5th, John de Northampton, along with his confederates More and Norbury, set out organising a popular rising against Brembe and his attack, not upon them, but upon London's constitution. They summoned the men of the crafts, the drapers and the mercers, and any other sympathisers to a meeting in the cemetery of St. Mary le Bow, the church to which Northampton's fraternity had now moved permanently. Anyone who refused the summons, by the way, was threatened with a fine of 2 marks. That helped the numbers. About 500 men answered on Sunday, the 7th of February, led by the hardcore of Northampton's faction, which had been his supporters since the 1370s. When they were assembled, Northampton appeared himself at their head, and they set off to march through Westcheap and St. Paul's Churchyard to Fleet Bridge. It appears that his intention was to lead them to the Church of the Carmelite Friars, just off Fleet Street. It was well known that the Carmelites were favoured by the Duke of Lancaster, and John de Northampton may have believed that if he led his followers there, he was going to receive the Duke of Lancaster's support and orders. We'll get back to that in a second. What happened when he marched, however? Well, Nicholas Brembe heard of this when he was at dinner with some of the aldermen up in Wood Street, and he'd heard that Northampton had assembled his followers in the cemetery of St. Mary le Bow and was leading them through the city. Brembe immediately went in pursuit with the few men he could muster and sent his servant ahead to order John Northampton to stop. Northampton refused at first, but the two sides ended up lining up on either side of Fleet Bridge. Now, meeting him in person, Northampton was challenged again, and he said, quite jauntily, that him and his friends were all going to pay their respects at the tomb of the Earl of Nottingham's brother, who'd been buried in that Carmelite church. At this cheeky reply, the mayor tried a third time to persuade Northampton to lead his followers away from Fleet Street, but he refused. And at this point during the standoff, Brembe was reinforced by more armed keepers of the peace from the wards, and flushed with numbers, Brembe decided to attack. As he had with Wat Tyler only a year or so earlier, Brembe clearly decided that if you take out the leader, the rest will follow. Unfortunately, this did not work out as it had on Wat Tyler. As Brembe's men rushed forward and seized John de Northampton, the brother of John de Northampton, Robert Camberton, and Brembe's servant, Thomas Usk, tried to immediately rescue him by force. Fighting broke out. Luckily, the fighting resulted in the two also being arrested alongside Northampton. And in the confusion and the melee, Brembe took the advantage. John de Northampton and these two others were snatched back as prisoners to his own townhouse. But this was not a bunch of rustics from Kent they were fighting. These were savvy Londoners. They did not retreat or break up just because their captains had been captured. They regrouped, they reorganised, and they surged. John de Northampton's followers fell upon the mayor's home of La Riole, a large crowd of them, and they attempted to break down the doors and release the prisoners. The attack on Brembe's house was serious, but remember, this was the house that had sheltered the Germans during the Peasants' Revolt, and now Brembe also had additional men to reinforce it. It was no pushover. Fighting broke out outside the mayor's home, but the attacks failed, and the crowd broke up. But they were not defeated. Northampton's supporters continued in the following days to hold their meetings. The cause was alive. They began to organise for a larger uprising. They planned this uprising to begin on Thursday the 11th of February, 4 days after the fighting on Fleet Bridge. A cordwainer called John Constantine, one of the leaders of the planned uprising, urged all the shopkeepers in Westcheap and Budgerow to close their shops as a sign of support of the insurrection. This seemed to have gained widespread support. Like the revolt of William Longbeard back in chapter 79, the cause was growing after the leader had been removed. Nicholas Brembe, however, he was way more prepared and way more ruthless than London's first mayor. Supposedly, after seeking out the advice of Sir Robert Knowles, Mayor Brembe sent out a snatch squad of goons and arrested John Constantine quickly. He dragged him to the Guildhall. There he held a show trial and sentenced him to immediate execution on Cheapside as an example to others. John Constantine was dragged by armed men to the busiest street in London, and there, probably near somewhere public like the Cheapside Cross, they beheaded him in full view of everybody, there and then. The stratagem worked, shock and awe, and the planned disorder petered out. Brembe had previously procured a royal writ for the removal of Northampton to Corfu Castle, and his brother and other associates were later removed to royal custody. Nicholas Brembe had regained control over London. His only threat was now being carted off to a royal dungeon. He was victorious. For now. In truth, John de Northampton had been played. And in this, there's a very distinct possibility that Brembe had gained secret support from those within the young king's followers. Why do I suggest this? Well, as a fact stand, Northampton's march out on the 7th, he was almost certainly tricked into summoning his followers by assurances that the Duke of Lancaster would support him. The Westminster Chronicle reported that he was encouraged and invited to go to the Carmelite Church by no less a person than Thomas Mowbray, the young Earl of Nottingham, one of the king's intimate friends. Hence why the excuse was given they were going to pay tribute at Mowbray's brother's tomb in the Carmelite headquarters. It seems most likely, from the sequence of events, that the circle of the king's friend, led by Mowbray and Robert de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, were using John de Northampton as a tool in a plan to incriminate the Duke of Lancaster to end his influence over the government by accusing him of treachery against the king, and by using John de Northampton to facilitate this. This plan failed, perhaps because Nicholas Brembe acted too quickly. But while this sounds like a fanciful accusation, it is worth saying that within a few weeks the Earl of Oxford made use of a Carmelite friar to accuse the Duke of Lancaster before the king of planning a conspiracy in which the citizens of London were involved. This was actually a really unique moment in the history of Richard II. And for that, I'm just going to divert just for a second to talk about this Carmelite friar by the name of John Latimer. According to the most reliable account of this event, Latimer approached the teenage king after celebrating Mass and told him that the Duke of Lancaster was plotting his death. You can imagine the shock, and the teenage monarch responded in total panic and ordered the Duke to be executed immediately. Luckily for John of Gaunt and the whole country, those people around the teenage king managed to stop him, pointing out, you know, can't execute anyone without a trial, technically. Richard conceded they may have a point there. He then asked John Latimer if anybody else was involved, and the friar replied that yes, there was, a guy called Lord Zouche of Haringworth. At this, young King Richard ordered a proper investigation to begin, and so the friar was led away to imprisonment. Once outside, however, he was intercepted by a group of knights, several of whom were retainers of the Duke of Lancaster. These guys resented the hell out of the slur cast upon the Duke, and so they took John Latimer into custody themselves and led him to an obscure cell. And there they beat the living snot out of this friar. And we're talking full-blown torture. They broke his arms, they broke his legs, they burnt him. They really went to work on him, demanding he reveal just who the hell put him up to this. Friar John Latimer apparently kept saying no one, and eventually they gave up. The king in the meantime had sent for Lord Zouche, and he said he had no idea who this guy was and what he was talking about. And John Latimer, now unsurprisingly close to death due to the savage torture he'd just experienced, begged at last, as a last favour, if he'd be allowed to have a private interview with Lord Zouche. Permission was granted and the interview took place, but no significant information was obtained. Tragically, within a few days, the unfortunate friar passed away. The full story of this weird affair will never be known, and there is much about it that remains incredibly obscure. Why the friar made the accusation in the first place, we have no idea. He could have made the accusation because he personally hated the Duke of Lancaster. Or maybe he hated John Wycliffe, and he was saying all this to get back at the man who supported John Wycliffe. Or he could have been, to be blunt, a little bit insane. The sources at the time seem to suggest it. But he also may have been goaded into saying this, or allowed access to the young king to say this, by the king's ally and person who hated John of Gaunt, Robert de Vere, the Earl of Oxford. Maybe. But if the Earl of Oxford is actually conspiring to use Carmelite friars to cause dispersions upon the Duke of Lancaster, then we have to consider that what may have triggered John de Northampton to march towards that Carmelite friary was a false flag. There is the suggestion, and it is only that, that John de Northampton had raised his forces and marched out because someone, possibly Robert de Vere, had somehow given him the impression that if he got to that location, instructions from the Duke of Lancaster would be waiting for him. But it's unproven. I'm just airing it out there. Let's get back to the story. The king acted quickly after the execution of John Constantine, and his attitude played a really crucial role in making sure that Londoners understood that the mayor was receiving full royal support. The king sent letters patent granting a retrospective permission to Brembe to carry out his execution of Constantine. Remember, mayors aren't supposed to execute anybody. And he also sent out letters approving the re-election of the incumbent alderman. Consequently, Nicholas Brembe, along with several other grocers, Philpot and Woolworth, were sworn in as aldermen in 1384. In July, the king also granted a pardon to a young grocer, a man called John Algar, who'd been implicated in the murder of Janus Imperiale in 1379. This pardon served as a clear indication that the Stapler faction had regained their most significant power. They could influence the crown. Brembe also strengthened his personal standing by making an effort to appease and pacify the good people of London. He reaffirmed the freedom to sell fish in London, which he had proclaimed in the autumn of 1383, on the 5th of March 1384. Similar ordinances for other foodstuffs were passed in July that same year. Cheap food was always considered a reliable means of preventing unrest. Brembe also showed mercy to those who had opposed him. A grocer called William Makew, who had joined the company in 1373 but had fallen on hard times, was brought before Brembe in May 1384. Makew confessed to expressing his dissatisfaction with the city's government, and also that he had said the mayor was out of order for executing John Constantine. As a result, he was sentenced to a year's imprisonment and a fine for saying this. However, the mayor decided, after requests of several aldermen, to release Mayhew very soon after he'd been imprisoned. Similarly, most of those who had participated in Northampton's attempted uprising were dealt with leniently and were merely imprisoned or given large fines to keep the peace. Keep in mind, however, John de Northampton and his lieutenants could not receive easy clemency. They were screwed. John de Northampton was in royal custody now, awaiting trial. In June 1384, Brembe summoned a meeting of the aldermen and the common council. They were asked to declare on their conscience who was responsible for the, quote, covens, congregations and frays, unquote, in the city since Brembe's election. And without any single dissident voice, they all named John de Northampton. The political climate of London had changed. Brembe and the grocers were now fully in charge. A larger common council of 268 members, which met in August just before John de Northampton's trial, declared itself with the same unanimity in favour of banishing John de Northampton from the city in the event that the king pardoned him. Northampton's trial took place at Reading before the King's Council in August 1384, when the Duke of Lancaster was conveniently in France. Thomas Usk, Northampton's former secretary, who'd been arrested alongside John de Northampton, had been won over by Nicholas Brembe, and now he gave evidence against John de Northampton, and many of the allegations that the radical was motivated purely by personal greed and arrogance all come from Usk selling out his former boss to save his own skin. Still, the trial was eventful, mostly because John de Northampton and his big gob managed to make the trial go very badly for him. Apparently, the story goes, when the accusations have been read out, the young king proposed that the Royal Council immediately move to judgment on the accused. John de Northampton, however, then stood up and declared, quote, I hope, my lord king, that you do not mean to proceed to judgment or to exercise jurisdiction in the absence of your uncle, the Duke of Lancaster, unquote. This barb provoked the teenager. He snapped, saying he was competent to sit in judgment, not only on Northampton, but on the Duke of Lancaster as well. As one historian's account says, quote, he forthwith sentenced Northampton to be hung, drawn and quartered, with confiscation of all his professions. It was reported that the Queen interceded for his life, but the commuting of the sentence to life imprisonment was probably the result of Richard's cooler reflections, unquote. But Northampton was now out of the picture. Life imprisonment. And now Brembe could go after his closest followers too. Now, Northampton's close companions, Essex, Moore and Norbury, actually remained at liberty for some time after Northampton's arrest. The king only ordered their imprisonment after judgment had been passed on Northampton at Reading. Moore and Norbury were mercers, you see, and it's probably likely that Nicholas Brembe didn't want to arrest them because he depended on the support of the other mercer aldermen. Moore and Norbury had long commanded the loyalty of the retailers amongst the mercers' craft because they had led their struggle against the Italians. And there were few mercers who were willing openly to condemn Northampton's henchmen. Still, Brembe was a leopard. He needed to eat their faces. He just had to make sure that he was not the one doing it personally. So what Brembe did was actually really smart. He appointed a mercer called John Bosham to act as deputy mayor while he went to Reading for the trial of John de Northampton. Therefore, when the order came down to arrest Northampton's followers, it wasn't Brembe doing it. It was a fellow mercer. Now, William Essex was apparently warned of his impending arrest and he fled to Westminster and was given sanctuary. Moore and Norbury, however, were arrested, dragged over, tried in the Tower of London and were also sentenced to death. The sentence again was commuted to life imprisonment. With its leaders in prison, John de Northampton's faction should have disintegrated. But it didn't. Despite the execution of John Constantine and the arrest and life imprisonment of the principal leaders, the cause continued. If anything stands as proof positive that the resistance to Nicholas Brembe was never about John de Northampton, but the cause of the resistance, this is it. This was a struggle for the future of London. And Brembe sought to come down on the Moor. He knew he still faced opposition and he increased his own political power. Nicholas Exton was readmitted to the franchise and the grocer Carlisle to civic office. The enlarged Common Council at the end of July now included 32 members of the grocer's company, more than a tenth of the whole thing. And it was using this council that Brembe kept pushing back the reforms that were galvanising the opposition. The council asserted to the new electoral measures introduced by Brembe, election of the sheriffs and mayor were to be made not just by the common councillors chosen by the wards, but also by, quote, the more sufficient men of the city, unquote. In other words, the popular will was to be counterbalanced by men chosen for their wealth and standing. They decreed that henceforth two names should be put forward for the mayoralty of London, one of whom to be nominated by the sitting mayor, and the aldermen were to suggest another. According to Brembe, these measures were necessary to prevent factions such as Northampton's ever again being able to control the election of the civic officers. But it sure as hell like he was making sure that henceforth, London would be run by the oligarchs for its oligarchs. Northampton and his top henchmen might have been imprisoned, but there remained in the minds of the drapers and the mercers a suspicion and fear which Northampton had built up, but also had caused by Brembe's consistency of betrayals over the years previously. Wouldn't Nicholas Brembe commit the city to supporting the interests of the wool trade at the expense of everybody else? The dominating personality and strong will which had enabled Brembe to defeat Northampton was also the reason why he had a shedload of people who hated him. The anti-Brembe forces looked for a new leader, and they discovered him in the guise of the goldsmith, Nicholas Tyford, whom Brembe had humiliated back when he was a sheriff. The resentment towards the grocer fueled the goldsmith's readiness to accept the leadership of the diverse groups that feared and envied Brembe. Tyford was actually a formidable figure. It was evident before the upcoming mayoral election that violence was imminent. Similar to the previous election against Northampton, the King's support was crucial to Brembe. Lord Neville of Raby, Lord Fitzwalter and Sir Thomas Moreau were dispatched by the King to ensure the election was conducted fairly and to maintain the peace in the city. However, Brembe was not one to take any chances. On the day of the election, Brembe concealed men from his country estate at Harrow inside the Guildhall, instructing them to prevent anyone who was not legally summoned from entering the building. The opposition of London, now predominantly composed of tailors, goldsmiths and armourers, mostly individuals of low economic and social standing, were organising out on the streets of London. Their anger had resurfaced again. On the day of the mayoral election, they met together in St. Paul's, and from there they marched on the Guildhall with the intention of getting Nicholas Tyford elected mayor, and were also prepared to use force to back it up. A tailor went around attempting to stir up wider support by claiming that the organised guilds alone should elect the mayor, and that the King's representative should not be at the election. Probably many joined them at the Guildhall, such as William Woodcock, a tailor who, quote, went thence to his shop and fetched a sword, buckler and poleaxe, hoping that a riot would arise, unquote. A crowd turning up to prevent the re-election of Brembe was now armed and packing. Inside the Guildhall, the grocers, strongly represented though they were, did not have the numerical strength to automatically re-elect Brembe without the support of the men of the other guilds. However, from the point of view of the men inside the Guildhall, they were all now targets of the mob outside. The appearance of a mob with swords, bucklers and poleaxes was then matched by the uproar and confusion caused when they tried to get in and Brembe's men from Harrow were waiting for them, and the vicious fighting that happened as Brembe's men beat them off. And it probably convinced the men inside that they needed a mayor of strength and determination to bring quiet to the city. Nicholas Brembe was re-elected mayor again. Immediately after his re-election, Brembe went out with an armed following onto Cheapside to break up the rioters and to seek out their leaders. He sent his men out to scour the surrounding streets and sent off to Newgate any he found trying to stir up the rebellion. Street battles and skirmishes abound. The mayor placed a lot of pressure on the heads of the guilds who had seen their members involved. In the following days, the masters of the armourers, the tailors, the mercers and the goldsmiths brought the culprits before the mayor, one by one. Brembe showed leniency to most of them, whom he freed on bail, but with the threat of heavy penalties if they again took part in, quote, covens, conventicles, plots or congregations against the peace, unquote, or if they even dared to disobey the officers of the city. Others, though, presumably the leaders, were imprisoned for up to 2 years before they too were released on bail. This mixture of leniency to many and severity towards a few actually paid off. The street movement John de Northampton had created and schooled had lost their last attempt to control the politics of the City of London. They had been defeated by Brembe's ruthlessness, and he had been aided by the support given to him by the young king. And with that, it seemed to be over. Only it actually wasn't. There's a couple more twists in this tale to come, and they'll be revealed in the next few parts, where we'll see the end of the saga of the Jubilee. So, That's it from me. Whew, hope you enjoyed it. Fast-paced episode. And next week we carry on. What happened next? Because trust me, things are about to get way more complex. All right, this is Saul. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you then. Bye.